Are you a Hamilton fan? I have mixed feelings.
Hamilton, the musical or the person?
They are related questions. I will accept answers to either or both.
Mostly yes to both.
Really? Okay. Yeah. Do you think it treats Aaron Burr and Thomas Jefferson fairly?
Probably not entirely, but I'd say as a way of capturing. I mean, I think he did an extraordinary job capturing the life and the complexity of the period.
By treating Aaron Burr and Thomas Jefferson unfairly, does it cast the Federalists into too strong a light and discredit the Democratic Republicans too much?
I don't know about that. I mean, I think it's clearly a bit of a one-sided portrayal, but I think it gets at the, for us, for Suzanne and me, my co-author, the essential thing about the period is the conflict, right? Just the sort of two incommensurable views about what the country should be and what direction it should go. And I think it captures that pretty well. That is really almost more important than, sort of which side he takes.
So you agree that it's conservative propaganda, but you think it's well done conservative propaganda?
I wouldn't say it's conservative propaganda.
What would you, if it were propaganda, propaganda on behalf of whom? Other than Alexander Hamilton, but anything, anything that carries through forward.
I don't know. I don't like trying to read that kind of thing into a work of art. It's a well done show. It's pretty true to Chernow's biography of Hamilton. And I don't think we need to go any farther than that.
Okay. Does it come up in class? Is it something you talk about with students?
Yeah, occasionally. I mean, I can usually get a laugh out of them if I'm talking about this stuff and I mention the musical.
Right. It's at least a good laugh line. That's great.
But it does. It's for even the ones who have seen it or at least know the songs, it kind of sets their mind so that they understand that there was, this kind of intense politics back then in the same way that we see today, which is for me is helpful.
All right, well, we're about to get started. Last July, President Donald Trump suggested delaying the election. Of course, he lacked the power to do so, but it got people thinking. There's also been a discussion of if the ballots are the problem. If we just not have the ballots, we wouldn't have to worry about a peaceful transition of power. Of course, the president is also not committed to such a peaceful transition of power. In previous interviews, previous discussions, we have had authors who've suggested in their minds this is the most dire time that they have witnessed in democracy in their lifetimes, and maybe the most dire time since the Civil War. Coming on right now is Robert Lieberman, political scientist, head of that department at Johns Hopkins University. He writes extensively on American political development. His new book is The Four Threats, and he joins us right now. Robert, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Is the current threat or set of threats facing American democracy unique in our nation's history, or where might it find parallels?
Well, the basic thrust of the book is that there are a number of things that we know threaten democracy, and we learned this from studying democracy elsewhere. When Suzanne Mettler, my co-author, and I started thinking about this book, we would talk to colleagues, other political scientists who study sort of the rise and fall of democracy elsewhere in the world. And they would say things to us like, we've seen this before. Democracies come and go. We've had a pretty good run in the United States. And then they'd start reeling off countries where democratically elected leaders had taken the country down a path toward authoritarianism. And so we realized that looking at democracy elsewhere could give us insights into threats to democracy in the United States. So what we did was we thought about the major things that scholars of politics know are challenges to democracy and looked at American history to see if we could find those threats present in the past. And so what we found was that there have been a number of times in our history when some of these threats have coalesced and come together. But this is the first time that we've been able to find that all four of the threats that we outline have come together all at once. So I think, yes, this is really a dire crisis for American democracy.
So you've seen each horseman appear at different times of American history or in history of other countries you view around the world, but the four horsemen coming together signals the kind of apocalypse that we haven't been used to recently.
That's right. I mean, I think that signals to us that this is a very serious crisis.
What's the first one that struck your fancy? What was the first threat that triggered you getting in this journey to write the book?
The first threat that we outline is a familiar one to people who have been thinking about American politics and watching it for a while now, and that's polarization. The division of politics into real us versus them kind of camps. Any democracy relies on some amount of division. You know, we disagree about policy, we disagree about what the government should or shouldn't do. We disagree about the direction the country should go. That's great. That's fine. That's how democracy is supposed to work. When that kind of division divides the country into these, you know, incommensurable, overlapping, really us versus them camps, that's when it becomes dangerous. And we've noticed that in countries around the world. And that's been, a feature of American politics now for several decades.
Say more about how you define polarization. I'm going to hear that. And then because I have some challenge with the metaphor, but how do you define, say more about how you define polarization?
Well, there are a number of ways that political scientists think about polarization. Sometimes it's just, are people close together in their policy views or in their, on the liberal or conservative scale, or are they far apart? And we talk about polarization as meaning that people are far apart rather than close together. But there's another meaning of polarization. And this is what, when we write about polarization, what we really are talking about is a style of politics almost, where winning, where beating the other team becomes a singularly important objective, the most important thing. And that happens when, as today, the parties are very closely divided. If you think back a couple of decades, pretty much every national election, whether congressional election or presidential election, both parties have had a reasonable chance of winning. So when the parties are so closely divided and elections are so competitive, then this sort of teamsmanship, the idea that that our team has to beat your team, and that's the most important thing, that idea, that kind of strategic imperative takes hold. And you can see this in Congress in the last couple of decades. You can see this increasingly over the last couple of decades also among the public. We've sorted ourselves out increasingly according to our political affiliations. We used to think of Americans as having what we call cross-cutting cleavages, the idea that we all belong to a lot of different groups and have a lot of different affiliations. And you would encounter in your life people who think differently from you. But increasingly, we've sorted ourselves out so that the people we live with and the people we go to school with and the people we work with and the people we go to church with share common characteristics.
Yeah, the big sort is part of the canon for our community, part of the canon for this show. We actually talked to the author when he was writing the book years ago and was thinking about putting it. He did not include a chapter about our organization, but he was talking to us about doing a chapter on our organization back in the day. So we watched it with great interest and it overlapped with our sort of critique. So I hear what you're saying about kind of the uber partisanship for its own sake. I even look, and this doesn't even mean greater separation in terms of ideology. I think about Newt Gingrich and Mitch McConnell. I don't know which of, if they have a particular philosophical disagreement that I would identify readily, but there was a different approach. When Newt Gingrich was Speaker of the House and he had President Bill Clinton, he thought of that as an opportunity. Well, with this guy in the White House, what parts of my agenda can I accomplish? Well, I might be able to accomplish welfare reform. I might be able to accomplish Telecommunications Act. Which part of my things would Clinton be down with? When Mitch McConnell saw Barack Obama, he said, ah, that is the enemy. The only objective that I can have just rightly is not figuring out what we agree on, but how can I tank him? And that is, and so I hear about that and I understand that. I do want to offer my quibble. I guess I'm lobbying political science right now. And you, as the head of the political science department at Augusta University, I want to challenge the term polarization. Because when I think of the word pole, I think of a planet that is has a north and a south pole that are roughly, not roughly, precisely equidistant, that have roughly, maybe even precisely, common centers of gravity. And it delivers this idea of American symmetry in our politics, which I think is misleading. I think it is misleading when I listen to the New York Times talking about why has the left not put as much money into judgeships, thinking that, well, there's sort of these, it's Coke and Pepsi, it's kind of two co-equal poles. Is that where, when in fact it's been a project to address the American judiciary, it happened to be more located, strongly more located in one party, but not because, not in my view, necessarily because that was a poll. Am I too picayune in my critique of that metaphor, or is there an asymmetry that is worth acknowledging that does matter in some way?
You're absolutely right. There's no question that polarization in the United States is asymmetric. That is, in a couple of senses, I think you're right that the Republican Party has moved farther to the edge than the Democratic Party. But I also think that that this sort of this teamsmanship idea, the strategic idea that beating the other guy is the overriding imperative, has taken root in the Republican Party. To a really great degree, more so than the Democratic Party. The Republican Party is unified by that objective. And I think there's a through line. You were talking a minute ago about Newt Gingrich and Mitch McConnell. Yeah, no, so you're absolutely right that there's an asymmetry between the parties. This is not a situation where both parties have moved to the polls equally. The Republican Party has become increasingly committed to a fairly narrow set of policy programs. And they've also taken on this idea of teamsmanship, that the overriding objective is to beat the other team, I think, to a greater degree. And the sort of basic pillars of democracy that we identify in the book, free and fair elections, the rule of law, the idea of a legitimate opposition, and the integrity of basic rights, tend to take a back seat to this need to beat the other team. So I think you're right. The polarization metaphor is a little bit misleading in that it implies that
because I think you're onto something. Yeah, I think you're onto something, right? Because it also suggests, I maybe should write something about this, because it also suggests not only symmetry, but also that they are static, right? Because political, they're like the poles are where they are, right? And they are the gravitational field. But that's not, I mean, our gravitational field moves, right? Where political parties are moves. They don't stay in the same place. And I guess poles of a planet also move, but very rarely. So what might be, how might else, and I don't, we don't need to just stick with semantics, but how might else we describe this uber teamsmanship? And is there, because that you're really onto something about that does feel fundamentally different. I think a lot of it is the sorting mechanism, the sorting dynamic that you've discussed, right? It used to be that you had genuinely liberal and genuinely conservative Republicans and genuinely, like actually not only, you know, people sort of who met in the middle, but in fact overlapped, right? Where you'd have really oddball coalitions. You don't have that in American politics as you did prior to, you know, let's say the Civil Rights Act. So I think that is a huge dynamic. Feel free to say more about that dynamic. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, if you back up a little bit and think about what we mean by democracy, you know, what we really mean is a system of government that allows voters to hold those in power accountable. And when a democratic system is working effectively, that means that that it's in the interest of politicians, of those in power, to try and make progress on solving public problems. And often that means compromise, accommodation, trying to, you know, you want to win because you think your people and your ideas are better than the other teams. But you also are committed to the idea that the democracy is the best way of resolving problems. What this kind of teamsmanship often leads to is the idea that politics is not this process of accountability and mutual accommodation, but what we call mortal combat, that the only objective is to beat the other team. Yeah. And whether that means, you know, fiddling with the rules or just undermining the rules, doesn't matter. That becomes
more tertiary concern. It's only what pointy-headed nerds on a podcast like this or in the political science department at a university might care about.
Yeah. Well, people do care about it. I mean, that's one of the we may be jumping ahead to the end
a little bit,
but people, Americans do care about democracy. Public opinion surveys show that people are committed to the idea of democracy. So it really muddies the water when one of the parties has gone so far off the rails.
Let's get to your second threat. You say who belongs. Without putting words in your mouth, what comes to my mind is India right now is defining who rules, not only based on ideas, but based on who can participate, and basing that participation on a set of racial or religious criteria. How do you think about the question who belongs?
Yeah, that's a good analogy. I mean, who belongs is really about who is entitled to full membership and full status in the society and all of the rights and responsibilities and obligations that that entails. And what we see around the world is that, especially when that conflict coincides with what some political scientists call formative rifts, conflicts that go back as far as the history of the country itself.
Yeah, before. Middle East.
Yeah, or race in the United States,
yep.
Right?
I don't like to think about our own rifts. I only like to cast aspersions on the rifts of other cultures while trying to hide my own patriotism and shielding my eyes from history.
Right, fair enough. But it's hard to think about American democracy and escape that
right.
Challenge. And when that challenge is there and sort of underlies a politics over a long period of time, it's very hard to escape. And when that kind of conflict is activated, and when politics is fought because the fight is not just over the sort of mutual accommodation that I was describing before, but over who really belongs as part of the society and who doesn't.
Are there countries that have made it through? And I'm still hopeful and optimistic and even occasionally Pollyannish in how the United States has made some progress. But are there countries who have made it through formative rifts, well? And what can we learn from them?
That's a very hard question. It's not generally a happy story. I mean, formative these kinds of formative rifts are very hard to overcome. And I think, you know, there are times, and one of the things we find in the book is that there are times when they really animate politics and they become the dividing line on which politics is fought. And that can be extremely dangerous. There are other times when they're sort of off to the side, sometimes because everybody agrees that's not something we should address. You know, there have been times, certainly in American history, there have been times when we've really reckoned with our formative rift, which is race and the status of African Americans. We don't deal with those in the book per se, which makes the book a little perhaps dark.
Yeah.
But if you think about Reconstruction or the civil rights era in the late 20th century, these were, you know, the two great democratizing moments in the United States.
Yeah.
So there is precedent for making progress.
And one of the reasons I bring it up is I actually think this is what inspires me is I think America's the chance. So we think of often, right, like where are we in the stage of American development? And maybe where we are is the fall of Rome, right? Maybe this is the last, you know, this is the ninth inning in a 9-inning game, and it's mm-hmm. or maybe the 8th inning, and it's been cool and some cool stuff happened, but all empires fall. But there's another narrative that's possible. Another narrative is there hasn't been a country that has figured out how to operate cohesively with as great a degree of racial and religious diversity as this country. And that we have a chance to chart a new chapter, to do something that if you're a fan of, as we were talking about, you know, Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson, despite the historical deep sin of slavery, if you're still a fan of the dawn of America, that maybe we still got another act in us. Maybe we got another album, and maybe we get, and maybe it's our third or fourth album. Maybe that album is about solving this thing, addressing formative rifts in ways that other countries haven't figured out. Maybe we got another act in us.
I certainly hope so. And that, you're right. That is to us the overriding recurring challenge of American democracy, is how to build a democratic society that can endure in that kind of multiracial, multi-ethnic context. You know, and as I said, there have been eras in American history when we've made progress toward that goal. And overall, you know, I think we're closer now than we were at the founding to being a full, robust democracy, in terms of the breadth of rights, the you know, people who were originally excluded, who are now at least nominally included within the fold of American democracy. But the other side of the story, and we find this repeatedly, is that the crises of democracy that we chronicle over two centuries often have a settlement or a resolution that involves, you know, backsliding on race. So one of the episodes we look at is the 1850s, which ends in the Civil War.
Yeah,
not a very happy outcome for democracy, or the 1890s, which results in the mass disenfranchisement of Black men in the South. So it's not an overall happy progressive story, which is what a lot of people think about American democracy. Yes, you know, when the country was founded, it was not a complete democracy. African Americans were excluded, women couldn't vote, and so on and so forth. But over time, we've expanded and grown and progressed to include more.
No, it ain't that clean. And even the line, the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice, suggests that there it has an arc, when in fact it's bumpy and doesn't all head the same direction all the time. It's sort of like even the polarization discussion, right? We like to think of things in a nice circle, but or you know, in pleasantly shaped objects, but it isn't always pleasantly shaped.
Yeah, that's part of the message of the book, is that this is not a story of sort of inexorable, inevitable progress towards some state of perfection, which doesn't mean we shouldn't be striving for it or thinking about what it would look like and how to get there. But we can't take it for granted that American democracy will always be there, or that the Constitution will always save us, or that we're always going to be going in the right direction.
So you don't think history is over?
I absolutely do not think history is over.
Did you think history was over when he wrote that history was over? Did you dance with that idea, or do you think it was wrong right away?
I was a skeptic. I think, you know, when Francis Fukuyama wrote that piece, whenever that was, around the end of the Cold War, that was really about the sort of global geopolitical conflict between liberal democracy and communism.
Yeah, and a great title too.
It was a great title, yeah. But I think one of the things that our book underscores is that even inside liberal democracy, there's plenty of history still to come.
How did you decide which threat went first in the book? You got four threats. Did you roll? Was it temporal? Did you roll dice? Is it based on priority? How'd you think that through?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, it was really temporal, because the first episode that we chronicle in the book is the 1790s, the first decade right out of the gate after the Constitution is adopted. And what do we see? We see the beginnings of this kind of intense polarization. So polarization is not only first sort of analytically, because that is one of the things that political scientists across the board recognize as a serious challenge now, but it was really the first challenge that the country faced right out of the gates.
I want to get to your next one, which is economic inequality. And if we were talking about other eras in history, there are people, I could imagine people who would prioritize each of these first, right? Like, I have to imagine in Russia at the turn of the last century, and heck, a lot of, even to some degree, the progressive era at the turn of the last century in the United States, the issue of economic inequality, they might have put first. They might have put before sort of Ezra Klein's political polarization. At the time of the civil rights era, we probably would have put first who belongs as the number one thing. But let's get to that economic inequality. We now understand it better, I think, than we did before. We recognize that it drives stress. We recognize that the Richard Wilkinson's, I think we've seen Richard Wilkinson's studies that have demonstrated that once a country is rich, if it gets richer, it doesn't have that much obvious positive impact on life expectancy or alcoholism rates or anything we care about, but bigger wealth disparities sure do, and they end up tearing countries apart. What are the things you've noticed that you really want to highlight about how economic inequality impacts democracy and presents a threat?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, it's not just high inequality, it's rising inequality. So it matters not just how big inequality is at any one moment.
Say more about that.
Which direction is it going? Is it getting worse or is it getting better? Right. That's one point.
And say more about that. Is that because what comes to my mind is, well, because it feels like it's getting better, then at least I buy into the society because I think I got a chance going forward. Or it's getting worse. I'm like, screw this. I'm not in this anymore. Is that simplistic?
That's simplistic, but that's more or less it. But on top of that, people often think about this the wrong way. People think about inequality as a challenge to democracy. Often because they worry that what's going to happen is the poor, the people at the lower end of the spectrum are going to sort of rise up and overthrow those in power. When really what happens is the reverse. It's the wealthy, it's the people at the top mm-hmm. who get nervous that in a true democracy, right, there are more poor and lower and middle income people than there are rich people, right? And so the wealthy get worried that their gains and that their wealth is vulnerable. And so they start to take action and work together.
What are some of the key examples? What are some of the key examples that you want to highlight? I mean, what comes to my mind, and I'm trying not to cast aspersions, but I do think about when I first started paying attention to international politics to some degree. I was in high school or college, and there was the caning in Singapore, and I learned a couple of things. One, that Singapore had a more authoritarian, or at least a more, let's call it strict, law enforcement system than many other countries. And they're one of the only countries that has similar wealth disparities to us, right? That big a difference between rich and poor. And that stuck with me for years. What are examples, you can disabuse that one, or what examples that occur to you for where the sort of economic elites have said, uh-oh, a lot of poor people now, we better not engage in democracy, we better crush it.
Well, I mean, the way we think about this in the book is not to look at examples in other countries, but to look at examples right in our own history.
Darn it! I keep trying to hold on to my patriotism like a little bunny. Pet it.
No, it's
good patriotism.
It's valuable, but it's often hard when you sort of look under the hood. So, you know, the 1890s was a time of like today, of high and rising economic inequality and the consolidation of power among the wealthy. At those times, you know, democracy again becomes a secondary goal. It becomes less important to those in power or to those who aspire to power than, you know, realizing or protecting particular policy gains, tax rates or deregulation or whatever it might be. So that's really the risk.
The other one you get into is executive aggrandization, sort of what somebody else might call a rising authoritarian risk, an overweening presidency that, let's say, has an attorney general with a view that there ought to be a unitary executive that ultimately is an elected king. That one seems almost, it's interesting, it's fourth, because some people might think, well, that's almost what we mean by a threat to democracy, as if there was one person who ruled everything. What are the times in American history that you have viewed executive aggrandization have been as present or as risky as it might seem to some now?
Executive aggrandizement is really a 20th century phenomenon. So through the 18th and 19th century, the president was and the executive branch were not that powerful. The bureaucracy was small. And it really begins in the 20th century. The presidency becomes more powerful. Our story begins with Franklin Roosevelt, although sure. it goes back earlier than that. You know, Roosevelt takes power in the 1930s at a time of incredible crisis of both democracy and capitalism. There is a lot of fear in the United States that the United States is going to go, excuse me, the way of authoritarian regimes that are rising in Europe at the time. And Roosevelt, through the New Deal in World War II, leaves the presidency with a lot more power than when he took over.
Yeah, sure.
Mostly because Congress gave it to him.
Yep.
Because you know, we were in a crisis, and someone needed to do something. The executive branch grows, the administrative state grows, the White House staff grows. So all of a sudden, the president has more tools to direct the economy, to oversee the activity of the federal government, to be a real policy and popular leader. That grows over the course of the rest of the 20th century with the growth of the national security state, which again gives the president a lot more kind of more nefarious tools. The intelligence services grow, surveillance capability grows. In the hands of an unscrupulous president, this kind of power can be dangerous. And that's what you get with Richard Nixon in the 1970s, right? He comes into office in a much more powerful presidency.
Yeah, you have an FDR administrative state, plus you have a Truman and post-Truman, sort of post-World War II, Cold War era military apparatus, intelligence apparatus, and then arrives Richard Nixon.
Right, exactly. Nixon is a president who wants to use this apparatus for his own political purposes. And he, you know, what we think of as the Watergate scandal is a small tip of a pretty big iceberg of stuff that Nixon and his White House people and his reelection campaign did to try and subvert the election of 1972, in short.
And apparently, even in 1968, right? I mean, even there were he was in cahoots with respect to the Vietnam War, with other agents trying to make sure that Lyndon Johnson didn't look right. like a hero in ending the Vietnam War.
Right, he tried to subvert Johnson's bombing halt right before the election.
Yeah.
Nixon used the power of the presidency. As we know from the stories of, you know, the Pentagon Papers and all kinds of dirty tricks and what became the Watergate scandal, which was sort of a screw up, because the guys weren't even supposed to be there the night they were got caught. They had to go right. back a second time to fix the bugs that weren't working from the first break-in. What saved...
Yeah, the reason Watergate got famous wasn't because it was the biggest piece of the corruption, but because it was the most bungled and easiest to prove element of the corruption.
Right, exactly. And it gave the Justice Department and the FBI and journalists a piece of thread that they could use to unravel a whole lot of other stuff that we now
right.
understand. What's interesting, though, is when we look back, Watergate... is almost the sort of purest example of a sort of democracy saving moment that we found in the book, and which is counterintuitive because, you know, we think of Nixon as a sort of proto-Trump, this would-be authoritarian who wanted to use whatever power he had in the White House to keep himself in power. But it was a period when polarization, as we generally think about it, was relatively low. The parties yeah. weren't that far apart. This was, you know, pre-Newt Gingrich, before...
I see where you're going. Keep going. But this is a really mostly I've heard people talk about parallels, and I have been most interested in the division. So yeah, keep going. This is interesting, the differences, rather.
So the other threats were relatively low. You know, we were just at the end of the civil rights era, and so the temperature on civil rights was lower than it had been for a while. Economic inequality was relatively low.
One of the biggest middle classes in American history.
At what we now understand was the tail end of this generation of prosperity
yep.
after the New Deal and World War II.
And it felt and to use your term previously, and it felt like things were, people had the anticipation that they were going to do better than their parents, right? Even if it actually was kind of at the high water mark of, it still felt like the trajectory was moving towards. It felt like
things were moving forward, exactly.
Yeah.
So, but what happened, what brought Nixon down was all of these other players in the game playing their constitutionally prescribed roles. So Congress investigated, and ultimately, for the most part, Republicans supported Nixon pretty much until the very end, but enough Republicans in the end recognized that the evidence against him was overwhelming. And so there was what looked enough like a bipartisan coalition against him that he was forced to resign. But also the Department of Justice, the courts, the press, everyone sort of played their role in this democratic system and brought a president down.
Yeah.
That to me is the really interesting parallel.
Why is that interesting parallel.
If that happened, 50 years ago and not this time around.
Well, I think you're on to it. And each of those things are different, right? There was a big middle class. We were adjacent to the civil rights era. It felt like things were moving, the arc of history was bending towards justice. It wasn't just a pivoting of to whom notions of racial oppression would be moved towards, but instead the dominant story of America was, hey, we're gonna get past this. We're gonna do better than this now. And you did have huge amounts of crossover. That still was a time when there was lots of crossover betwixt Democrats and Republicans. So it wasn't as clear who the tribes were, but it also gets to another, and I don't know if this is a threat or if this is like the sequel to the book, which is, four salvations. And what are those salvations? And one thing you had then was an active small L liberal media. And I don't mean, some partisan media. That's not how I view it. I think that's been largely propaganda, but there was a less commercialized, frankly, not quite as profitable, not 24-hour cable news, not clickbait worthy, but genuine journalism and respect for that. And a host of civic institutions that mattered. Also, political campaigns weren't quite as expensive, and you didn't have this enormous political apparatus that would bolster a candidate regardless. Like, to me, so much of the focus now, the reason I really appreciate this portion, so much of the discussion about Donald Trump focuses on what makes him different. To me, what's interesting is what makes this time different, as you're pointing out. Like, if you put Donald Trump back then and you bring Richard Nixon to now, right? Is there any reason, Richard Nixon survives, right? And Donald Trump goes down in the 70s. That's my guess. What's yours?
That may very well be. I think that's right, though, that we make a mistake when we pin this all on Trump. Trump is a symptom of the confluence of these four threats. And that's the ultimate argument or punchline of the book, is that these four threats, polarization, conflict over race, economic inequality, and executive aggrandizement, have all come together now. And that paved the way for a presidency like the Trump presidency. Trump didn't cause them, although he has an unerring instinct to make things worse all the time. But he's a product and not the cause of this. So, Nixon had a lot of Trump-like qualities. But you're right, he was president at a much different time.
I find your work hugely useful. And who was it? It's quoted to me as Einstein. It was not Einstein who said all theories are wrong, but some are useful. And I find the rubric you put together really, really useful. If we were going to speculate as to the blank number of salvations, right? The things, the moves that need to be made. And I want to encourage people to get the book. It's four threats. We're talking to Robert Lieberman, the professor at Johns Hopkins. When you think about how one responds to this confluence of not just one horse person at a time, but four horsemen of the risk of a Democratic small D apocalypse, what's the first salvation? Is it a move based on picking one of those and saying, okay, well, let's tackle one of those. Let's departisanize by creating a multi-party system and by doing ranked choice voting? Or is it just a huge movement around racial justice? Is the first move more economic equality? Is it just trying to cabin the presidency so the president doesn't move on? Or is it something else that touches all four simultaneously? Where do you start?
I think those are all really valuable ways of thinking about this, and would be, you know, those are the right things to do if we want in the long run to bend the curve a little bit. But those are all really hard things to do.
Let's just make everybody love each other. Yeah, let's just make sure that we shrink the gap between rich and poor. No, make sure that Fox News and Democrats love each other. Exactly. It's going to be great. We're going to start tomorrow.
Exactly. Those are really hard things to do. I think in some of them, you know, you could imagine a scenario where there's in January unified democratic control of the government, and we might be able to make some progress towards some of those things. I've actually been quite heartened watching the Black Lives Matter protests over the spring and summer. You know, I think there's a real willingness for a lot of people to reckon with the depth of systemic racism and the racial history of the country in a way that we haven't seen in a couple generations. That's not a panacea. There's a lot of conflict and politics between here and there. So there are things that are happening that might push us in those directions. I think, though, we need to find some lower hanging fruit.
All right.
We describe in the book what we call four pillars of democracy. I mentioned them a few minutes ago. These are the things that make democracy work, the things that you can observe and to see if democracy is really functioning well or not. There are free and fair elections, the idea that we need to have elections in which everyone has a right to participate, votes are tallied and weighed correctly, and they're decisive. You know, winners win and losers lose. The second is the rule of law, the idea that the law applies equally to everyone, and the idea that being in power doesn't exempt you from adherence to the law. Third is the idea of a legitimate opposition, the idea that, you know, you and I can disagree about something and even debate vigorously and compete in elections against each other, but we're antagonists, we're opponents, we're not enemies. And the fourth is what we call the integrity of rights, the protection of the rights that are necessary to make the other parts of democracy work, civil rights, civil liberties, and especially voting rights. So I think when we can look at all of those things, and we do this in the book, to see how healthy democracy is or is not. You know, if these things are all robust, then we can say that democracy is reasonably healthy and maybe even moving in the right direction.
Right.
Right now, we're seeing all of these things being degraded. But I think what we want, what we'd like readers of the book to come away with is that it's important to focus on these things, focus on democracy itself and make that a priority rather than just, you know, is my guy winning? Is my tax rate going to go up or down? Are the policies that I like going to happen or not?
Yeah.
You know, is my group going to sort of going to be advantaged or disadvantaged by this or that thing that the government does?
So I wanted to go back to your four pillars. And that's why I was sort of talking about like the four salvations, like the levers next, not only the things that exist. Because again, it's like, well, is the move then to repair one of those levers, or is there a salvation that even goes beyond that? And it gives us not eight, but 12 things to consider. And so for instance, like the free and fair elections thing, if I put my activist hat on, I can understand what that means, right? What that means is getting LeBron James to say on air, we got to work on voter suppression after he wins the NBA title, right? It was a little line. It was a big deal to say the words voter suppression by, you know, maybe the greatest basketball player of all time, the moment he's just won his fourth championship. Maybe he read your book and it was like his fourth pillar, his fourth championship. I'll move on. And I understand how, you know, going in and making sure, trying to get states to enact rules around, particularly purple states, enact rules around redistricting, that could matter. Trying to get automatic voter registration installed, lots of moves around that. I understand, my activist brain can think about that. Your third one though, the legitimate opposition, what does the activist brain do, right? Not only the describer, but the actor. What does the actor do? What does the change agent do to have some impact on the legitimate opposition pillar?
Well, first I'll say if LeBron wants a copy of the book, he should get in touch with us. We'd be happy.
He should totally. I'll call him.
Yeah, you do that. That'd be great.
Yeah. We'll text him.
I think that's really a hard nut to crack, because especially, you know, it goes along with polarization. It's sort of the flip side of polarization. If people come to see the other side as illegitimate, not a legitimate competitor, as an enemy to be vanquished rather than an opponent to be beaten in the election, but who might come back the next time and beat you,
yeah.
That's really hard to get over. But I think there are, there are things that I think people can agree on. There's middle ground on a lot of issues. And I think seeing some visible progress on some things like that might be a way into that. It's almost like a consequence of these other of the confluence of the threats, right? When politics gets so divided into these us and them camps, it's hard to see the other side as a legitimate antagonist.
And this is why I keep thinking about, when we do organizational planning, we think of priority and we think of sequencing. And sometimes the most important thing to do right now is the most important thing. And sometimes the most important thing to do is the first thing. So like Larry Lessig, one of our early guests, mm-hmm. had in his TED talk saying, listen, I'm not saying my issue is the most important issue. And he listed education and healthcare and climate change. He said, your issue is the most important issue, but this is first. If we don't get democracy figured out, the other stuff isn't going to get figured out. And so I think in terms of sequencing, as you think about sequencing, voting rights is one possibility. Another might in fact be changing the rules around parties. So then at least there's some change. And my thinking has evolved in this one. At least then there's some confusion that used to be provided by geography, right? Geography, Southern Democrat meant a very different thing than a Western Democrat, and a New England Republican meant a very different thing than an Arizona Republican. But if geography doesn't serve, if we've had a big sort, then it might be, well, the way we confuse up the and muddle up a little bit the political tribes so they aren't quite so tribal is with a change of the rules and kind of the party makeup. What's your favorite first move to start either rebuilding a pillar to address a threat or to do something that does things simultaneously?
Well, I think really, if you want to pick on the most dangerous thing that's happened to American democracy in the last decade or so, it's the degradation of voting rights.
Yeah,
I think the widespread voter suppression is really problematic, because that cascades and makes it harder to do all these other things, right? If one party is using this as a tool to keep itself in power, then that becomes really dangerous. And one thing we know about that's being really exposed right now about the American democratic system is that it can be pretty favorable to minorities. You know, the Electoral College, the Senate, allow a minority to sort of dig itself in.
Yeah, you don't read a racial minority. You mean the party that's the second most popular, but the right. First most popular in certain sectors.
Correct. That's right. That's an important distinction. So I think voting rights is really important. And I think again, Americans at least profess to believe this, right? Everyone should have a right to vote. Voting should be widespread and easy. And I think that making voting the sort of centerpiece of our national political life the way it should be would be a step in that direction. I mean, I think a lot of these structural reforms, are a couple of steps down the road if they're ever going to come at all, right? We're not going to get rid of equal representation in the Senate. That's the one part of the Constitution that's unamendable. We're not going to get rid of the Electoral College. I think, a multi-party system, there's sort of structural reasons that an electoral system like the United States tends toward a two-party system, right? With elections that are winner-take-all, there's not a lot of payoff for being a small party. So that's a hard,
To do proportional representation. And I can imagine that happening at some cities, right? I can imagine several cities around the country passing proportional representation for their own legislatures, maybe for their own city councils. But by the time that, bubbles up to Congress, it could be a while.
Right. And you've had times in American history when regionally focused parties have done pretty well in some elections, the populists in the late 19th century, the progressives in the early 20th century, they'd win mayoral races and governor's races and elect a few people to Congress from a region.
Yeah.
But they're not going to win the presidency. They're not going to win control of one of the houses of Congress. So, right. You know, the overwhelming tendency is for them to get absorbed into one of the two parties.
Sure.
I think the challenge we have now is that one of the two parties has veered so far from the Democratic path, you know, that as long as they stay in power, I think we're in dangerous territory.
And this is the... This gets to one of the biggest challenges that I have rhetorically and strategically, because I believe in two things. And I remember it was a conversation I had with Ezra Klein years ago. And when he mentioned, he said, well, the biggest problem, this is 10, 15 years ago. He said, the biggest problem facing American democracy is polarization. And I said, that was not my view. If we had defined polarization the way you did, I would use a different word. We've defined polarization as, hey, there is a team that is gaining in power, and it views its victory as not an accomplishment merely of a program, but as the destruction of its political enemy. And it views wins and losses based on that, even more than the accomplishment of its political program. Then that seems to me to be a bigger challenge then is it the problem polarization, or is the problem that movement is so powerful? And that gets to then, well, if what we're trying to do is legitimate opposition, if we're trying to do that, my cousins who I love dearly, who some of them wear MAGA hats, right? If what I'm trying to be is Rodney King and say, hey, can't we all just get along? And that's one thing I'm doing, to say, hey, we got to come together, buddy, we got to come together. And at the same time, I'm supposed to say, but wait a minute, that thing over there, that's real bad. You can't do that anymore. How do you navigate? What's the rhetorical architecture? What's the move? Or maybe you just got to pick to be able to say, we all got to get together. And the definition of getting together is screw that stuff over there.
That's exactly the challenge. I mean, you know, it's not clear how much we need to get together. As a, you know, democracy runs on disagreement. But what's happened is polarization, the sort of partisan teamsmanship that we've been describing, is coinciding with, you know, conflict over race and immigration right now. Where, you know, it's not just two teams, but one team that's increasingly white and whose adherents increasingly hold racially resentful views. You know, it sort of harken back to a time when whites were dominant in the United States.
Yeah,
and we're trying to recapture that. It's fused also with the sort of plutocracy, this economic divide, is where one party is doing the bidding of the business community and the wealthy, and using race, as we've seen a number of times in American history, using race as a polarizing tool. And all of that's happening at a time when the presidency is extraordinarily powerful. You know, so when a polarized Washington can't get anything done because Congress is so divided. Here you have a president, and this goes for presidents of both parties. This, again, is not a Trump phenomenon. A president who says, I was elected on a platform to do certain things, and Congress isn't letting me do them, but I've got all these tools that I can use to issue executive orders or change regulations or try to govern unilaterally. That just fuels resentment and fuels polarization. So it's the fusion of all these four threats that's really dangerous. It's not just polarization by itself.
Was Germany able to evolve from the Nazis after all? Is that an example? Maybe that's not a formative riff. That's maybe something else. But what's your thought on that one?
Yeah, I think that's a dangerous example to use because, you know, they had to get beaten in a pretty badly in a war to come out of that. So I'm not sure.
We don't want the whole world to unite against us and plunder much of the country in order to make change. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think that's right.
Well, I want to say thank you so much, man. I really appreciate it. We've been talking to Robert Lieberman, who has worked with his co-author to write the book, The Four Threats. Hugely appreciated. The Four Threats, the recurring crises of American democracy. Professor Lieberman, thank you so much for joining us. Any, I really do encourage people. It's a hugely useful. And I'll tell you something that gives me hope is it feels like, maybe it's only because I've been looking for it. I remember like my family when I was a kid bought a somewhat obscure car brand that I'd never seen before. And then after they got the obscure cars, I noticed them all over the place. It might just be that I've been engaging this a bunch, but it does seem like there are a lot of really great minds applying themselves to how we are going, in fact, to save democracy. And I really appreciate you engaging in that project. Any closing word from you?
I think, first of all, thank you for that. It's a great endorsement. But I think what's really important is that people need to focus on democracy. Democracy is really at risk. And I think the more we can keep that in mind as we think about politics and act in politics and vote, the better off we'll be.
The book is by Suzanne Mettler and Robert Lieberman. He's been with us. It is, again, The Four Threats, the Recurring Crises of American Democracy. Robert, Professor, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Be well. Democracy Nerd is produced and recorded in X-Ray Studios. Thanks to producer Kyle Curtis and Chase Spross. Thanks also to Kat Buckley for the graphics. I'm Jefferson Smith. We are at the beginning of this. Please subscribe and give us a 5-star review, even if it is only in the hopes that we eventually earn it. Help spread the word. You can check out X-Ray's podcast page, xraypod.com, for past Democracy Nerd episodes and other X-Ray offerings. And thank you, Democracy.